rise from poverty, his ultimate mastery of language and law, his capacity to overcome personal loss and remain determined in the face of repeated defeat. In all this, Lincoln reminded me, not just of my own struggles. No sooner had the essay appeared when Peggy Noonan, former Reagan speechwriter and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, chimed in. Under the title, Conceit of Government, she wrote, "This week comes the previously careful Senator Barack Obama, flapping his wings in Time magazine and explaining that he's a lot like Abraham Lincoln, only sort of better." She went on to say, "There is nothing wrong with Barack Obama's resume, but it is a log cabin free zone. So far, it is also a greatness free zone. If he keeps talking about himself like this, it always will be." Ouch. I was reminded of what my veteran colleagues already knew, that every statement I made would be subject to scrutiny, dissected by every manner of pundit, interpreted in ways over which I had no control, and combed through for a potential error, misstatement, omission, or contradiction that might be filed away by the opposition party and appear in an unpleasant TV ad somewhere down the road. In an environment in which a single ill-considered remark can generate more bad publicity than years of ill-considered policies, it should have come as no surprise to me that on Capitol Hill, jokes got screened, irony became suspect, spontaneity was frowned upon, and passion was considered downright dangerous. I started to wonder how long it took for a politician to internalize all this. How long before the committee of scribes and editors and censors took residence in your head? How long before even the candid moments became scripted, so that you choked up or expressed outrage only on cue? How long before you started sounding like a politician? There was another lesson to be learned. As soon as Ms. Noonan's column hit, it went racing across the internet, appeared in every right-wing website as proof of what an arrogant, shallow boob I was. Just the quote Ms. Noonan selected, and not the essay itself, generally made an appearance on these sites. In that sense, the episode hinted at a more subtle and corrosive aspect of modern media, how a particular narrative, repeated over and over again and hurled through cyberspace at the speed of light, eventually becomes a hard particle of reality, how political caricatures and nuggets of conventional wisdom lodge themselves in our brain without us ever taking the time to examine them. For example, it's hard to find any mention of Democrats these days that doesn't suggest we are weak and don't stand for anything. Republicans, on the other hand, are strong, if a little bit mean, and Bush is decisive no matter how often he changes his mind. A vote or speech by Hillary Clinton that runs against type is immediately labeled calculating. The same move by John McCain burnishes his maverick credentials. Of course, the PR machinery of politicians and their parties help feed these narratives. And over the last few election cycles at least, Republicans have been far better at such messaging than the Democrats have been. A cliche that, unfortunately for us Democrats, really is true. The spin works, though, precisely because the media itself is hospitable to spin. Every reporter in Washington is working under pressures imposed by editors and producers, who in turn are answering to publishers or network executives, who in turn are poring over last week's ratings or last year's circulation figures and trying to survive the growing preference for PlayStation and reality TV. To make the deadline, to maintain market share and feed the cable news beast, reporters start to move in packs, working off the same news releases, the same set pieces, the same stock figures. Meanwhile, for busy and therefore casual news consumers, a well-worn narrative is not entirely unwelcome. It makes few demands on our thought or time. It's quick and easy to digest. Accepting spin is easier on everybody. This element of convenience also helps explain why, even among the most scrupulous reporters, objectivity often means publishing the talking points of different sides of a debate without any perspective on which side might actually be right. A typical story might begin, "The White House today reported that despite the latest round of tax cuts, the deficit is projected to be cut in half by the year 2010. This lead will then be followed by a quote from a liberal analyst attacking the White House numbers and a conservative analyst defending the White House numbers. Is one analyst more credible than the other? Is there an independent analyst somewhere who might walk us through the numbers? Who knows? Rarely does the reporter have time for such details. The story is not really about the merits of the tax cut or the dangers of the deficit, but rather about the dispute between the parties. Indeed, part of what makes the juxtaposition of competing press releases so alluring to reporters is that it feeds that old journalistic standby, personal conflict. It's hard to deny that political civility has declined in the past decade, and that the parties differ sharply on major policy issues. But at least some of the decline in civility arises from the fact that, from the press's perspective, civility is boring. Your quote doesn't run if you say, "I see the other guy's point of view," or "the issue's really complicated." Go on the attack, though, and you can barely fight off the cameras. The spin, the amplification of conflict, the indiscriminate search for scandal and miscues. The cumulative impact of all this is to erode any agreed-upon standards for judging the truth. We have no authoritative figure, no Cronkite or Murrow, whom we all listen to and trust to sort out contradictory claims. Instead, the media is splintered into 1,000 fragments, each with his own version of reality, each claiming the loyalty of a splintered nation. Depending on your viewing preferences, global climate change is or is not dangerously accelerating. The budget deficit is going down or going up. I understand that facts alone can't always settle our political disputes. Our views on abortion aren't determined by the science of fetal development, and our judgment on whether and when to pull troops out of Iraq must necessarily be based on probabilities. But sometimes there are more accurate and less accurate answers. Sometimes there are facts that cannot be spun, just as an argument about whether it's raining can usually be settled by stepping outside. The absence of even rough agreement on the facts puts every opinion on equal footing, and therefore eliminates the basis for thoughtful compromise. It rewards not those who are right, but those, like the White House press office, that can make their arguments most loudly, most frequently, most obstinately, and with the best backdrop. Today's politician understands this. He may not lie, but he understands that there's no great reward in store for those who speak the truth, particularly when truth may be complicated. The truth may cause consternation. The truth will be attacked. The media won't have the patience to sort out all the facts, and so the public may not know the difference between truth and falsehood. What comes to matter then is positioning. The statement on an issue that will avoid controversy or generate needed publicity. The stance that will fit both the image his press folks have constructed for him and one of the narrative boxes the media has created for politics in general. The politician may still, as a matter of personal integrity, insist on telling the truth as he sees it, but he does so knowing that whether he believes in his positions matters less than whether he looks like he believes. That straight talk counts less than whether it sounds straight on TV. From what I've observed, there are countless politicians who've crossed these hurdles and kept their integrity intact. Men and women who raise campaign contributions without being corrupted, garner support without being held captive by special interests, and manage the media without losing their sense of self. But there is one final hurdle that once you've settled in Washington, you cannot entirely avoid. One that is assured to make at least a sizable portion of your constituency think ill of you. And that is the thoroughly unsatisfactory nature of the legislative process. I don't know a single legislator who doesn't anguish on a regular basis on the votes he or she has to take. There are times when one feels a piece of legislation to be so obviously right that it merits little internal debate. John McCain's amendment prohibiting torture by the U.S. government comes to mind. At other times, a bill appears on the floor that is so blatantly one-sided or poorly designed that one wonders how the sponsor can maintain a straight face during the debate. But most of the time, legislation is a murky brew, the product of 100 compromises, large and small, a blend of legitimate policy aims, political grandstanding, jerry-rigged regulatory schemes, and old-fashioned pork barrels. Often, as I read through the bills coming to the floor my first few months in the Senate, I was confronted with the fact that the principled thing was less clear than I had originally thought. That either an aye vote or a nay vote would leave me with some trace of remorse. Should I vote for an energy bill that includes my provision to boost alternative fuel production and improves the status quo, but that's wholly inadequate to the task of lessening America's dependence on foreign oil? Should I vote against a change in the Clean Air Act that will weaken regulations in some areas, but strengthen regulation in others, and create a more predictable system for corporate compliance? What if the bill increases pollution, but funds clean coal technology that may bring jobs to an impoverished part of Illinois? Again and again, I find myself poring over the evidence, pro and con, as best I can in the limited time available. My staff will inform me that the mail and phone calls are evenly divided, and that interest groups on both sides are keeping score. No legislator, state or federal, is immune from such difficult moments, and they are always far worse for the party out of power. As a member of the majority, you have some input in any bill that's important to you before it hits the floor. You can talk to the committee chairman to include language that helps your constituents, or eliminate language that hurts them. You can even ask the majority leader, or the chief sponsor, to hold the bill until a compromise more to your liking is reached. If you're in the minority party, you have no such protection. You must vote, yes or no, on whatever bill comes up, with the knowledge that it is unlikely to be a compromise that either you or your supporters consider fair or just. In an era of indiscriminate log rolling and massive omnibus spending bills, you can also rest assured that no matter how many bad provisions there are in a bill, there will be something. Funding for body armor for our troops, say, or some modest increase in veterans' benefits that makes the bill painful to oppose. Not surprisingly, there are activists who insist that Democratic senators stand fast against any Republican initiative these days, even those initiatives that have some merit, as a matter of principle. It's fair to say that none of these individuals have ever run for high public office as a Democrat in a predominantly Republican state, nor have they been a target of several million dollars worth of negative TV ads. What every senator understands is that while it's easy to make a vote on a complicated piece of legislation look evil and depraved in a 30-second television commercial, it's very hard to explain the wisdom of that same vote in less than 20 minutes. What every senator also knows is that during the course of a single term, he or she will have cast several thousand votes. That's a whole lot of potential explaining to do come election time. Of course, there are technical fixes to our democracy that might relieve some of this pressure on politicians, structural changes that would strengthen the link between voters and their representatives, nonpartisan districting, same-day registration, and weekend elections would all increase the competitiveness of races and might spur more participation from the electorate. And the more the electorate is paying attention, the more integrity is rewarded. Public financing of campaigns, or free television and radio time, could drastically reduce the constant scrounging for money and the influence of special interests. Changes in the rules in the House and the Senate might empower legislators in the minority, increase transparency in the process, and encourage more probing reporting. But none of these changes can happen of their own accord. Each would require a change in attitude among those in power. Each would demand that individual politicians challenge the existing order, loosen their hold on incumbency, fight with their friends as well as their enemies, on behalf of abstract ideas in which the public appears to have little interest. Each would require, from men and women, a willingness to risk what they already have. In the end, then, it still comes back to that quality that John F. Kennedy sought to define as he lay convalescing from surgery, mindful of his heroism in war, but perhaps pondering the more ambiguous challenges ahead, the quality of courage. In some ways, the longer you are in politics, the easier it should be to muster such courage, for there is a certain liberation that comes from realizing that no matter what you do, someone will be angry at you, that political attacks will come no matter how cautiously you vote, that judgment may be taken as cowardice, and courage itself may be seen as calculation. I find comfort in the fact that the longer I'm in politics, the less nourishing popularity becomes, that a striving for power and rank and fame seem to betray a poverty of ambition, and that I am answerable mainly to the steady gaze of my own conscience and my constituents.